I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Tanya Yuki. Tanya is the founder and CEO of Shareably, a leading provider of social content analytics for business. Tanya was recently honored with a Great Mind Award from the Advertising Research Foundation and featured in Fast Company and Forbes as one of the top 12 women driving digital in New York. Tanya received the 2014 L'Oréal Women in Digital Next Generation Award. She began her career as an attorney, specializing in digital rights management, IP, and film financing. After moving to the United States from Australia, Tanya went on to run an online video content network as head of acquisitions and branding and led product management for Comscore's Video Metrics, the world's leading online video rating service. Tanya is founder of Wimlink, an organization that holds regular events and seminars promoting entrepreneurship, leadership, and the professional development of women. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David. Very excited to be joining Smashing the Plateau.
Thank you. It's so great to have you on. You have such a fascinating background, and I wondered if you could start by talking a little bit about it. Particularly, you made a shift in your career early on, so I'd like to hear a little bit about that and then what you've done since making that shift.
You're very kind to refer to it as just one shift. When you read my background and my history and what I've dedicated myself to throughout the years, there's definitely quite a winding narrative. I think the biggest factor that's driven me has always been picking things which I thought were fun and which I found particularly inspiring. And that was probably what led me to the biggest shift of my career, which was moving from the content creation side over to analytics. And that's been one of the driving factors in starting Shareably. It was definitely a big reason which caused me to become a part of Comscore and their product team. But that was a pretty big shift for me and incredibly rewarding, but very unexpected if you look at my background.
Interesting. And what about going from your earlier training as an attorney into entrepreneurship?
Being trained as an attorney actually prepares you for many different things, not the least of which is being able to push through huge amounts of information and synthesize it and be able to think on the fly. I was pretty clear from early on within my legal studies that I probably wasn't going to practice, but I did find the study incredibly interesting. I believe it helped inform my process in thinking. So that was definitely a very rewarding time. But I was very clear even then that I probably wasn't going to be an attorney, that I would probably want to find a different outlet for that education.
Well, I have to confess that your path doesn't sound all that unusual to me, because my early training is in engineering, and I spent most of my professional life in leadership and management. Unlike you, I didn't realize at the time that I probably wasn't going to spend a lot of time in engineering, but in actual fact, I didn't. So it's interesting for me to hear how other people have also maneuvered through various paths in their career.
Well, I'll tell you what tipped someone's hand very early for me. So a good friend of my family back in Australia was a Supreme Court justice. And when I began law school, my parents thought it would be really beneficial for me to meet with him and learn about what the career paths would be and how to focus my studies. And he sat me down. He was this brilliant man. And advised me that the very best thing I could do would be to find one subsection of one area of law and do it over and over and over and just be the best person at this tiny fragment of this part of the legal practice. And the concept of focusing that intensely on one area and not having that variety and not having that diversity made it pretty clear for me that I would be a very unprofitable lawyer, because I'd be moving around trying to know too many things, which isn't scalable. So it was a good early tip off.
Interesting. So how do you think that that understanding of focus may have impacted what you've done as an entrepreneur? Because I know focus is also an important factor in what you do in business.
Yeah, to me, it was less about focus and it was more about understanding yourself and knowing if you are intrinsically variety seeking or intrinsically the kind of person who likes to mitigate risk and have things be quite predictable. And throughout my whole life, I've definitely been much more leaning towards the variety seeking, you know, being inspired by things that excite me or that I think are fun or are challenging. And when you find yourself using those kinds of words to describe your motivation and to describe your experience, it's a really good note to self that probably entrepreneurship is something that you're going to thrive on. If all of those words sound interesting but kind of give you acid just from hearing about it, then it probably isn't something which is going to be a rewarding career path for you.
You know, it's interesting that you should describe it that way, because I find that most people either are entrepreneurs or employees as far as their mindset is concerned, and there's not usually too much middle ground.
I completely agree with that. And I didn't understand that dichotomy, but when I reflect back on my career, I always approached work as if I was an owner. I always stressed, you know, hopefully as much as leadership did about all of the details and about what I was working on. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of what can tell you that, you know what, maybe owning that level of responsibility is something that you would find interesting and rewarding.
So let's talk a little bit about leadership. What do you see as some of the key ingredients for great leadership?
There's definitely many different leadership styles. For me, the biggest thing is clarity and transparency. And by clarity, not only being clear about what you're hoping people to rally around, but also that clarity of vision and clarity of purpose. And the second piece is around just removing as many of the unknowns and as much of the suspense as possible. There's definitely no silver bullet when it comes to being a successful leader, but I think if your team believes that you're being open, that you're telling the truth, that you're being clear and transparent about the standards that you're holding yourself to as well as them, it makes it a lot easier to, you know, muddle through some of the early challenges and to help people understand that we're all in this together and that there isn't anything that's being hidden. Because I think that's one of the biggest anxieties when you work in a team is what you don't have visibility into or what you don't understand that might be a governing principle and that sort of prevents you from being able to be successful in your role.
And if you're a team member, being afraid to ask what you don't know.
Right, which again, you know, comes down to if you believe that everyone tells the truth, if you believe that everyone is open, it's much easier to foster an environment in which people are going to be willing to put up their hand and say, actually, I don't understand that, or shock horror, actually, I don't agree with it. I think this other thing might be better, which is definitely the kind of environment that you want to foster.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about what you see as the ideal culture for a business to thrive in 2015.
I can only speak from the perspective of our business. There's so many different environments that really work for different kinds of leaders. I think a lot of this is very top down and it depends on who you bring on early. For me and for us at Shareably, we have a culture of iterating very quickly, of being open, of having as much fun as possible and taking it all very seriously, but not to the detriment of being able to play a prank or, you know, laugh about something which you otherwise might be upset about. And to keep that, I guess, that spark or that quirkiness around it, which you can often lose when you grow too big too fast. And it's something that I think a lot about because we are growing incredibly quickly. how do we hire not only the very best people, but also the very best people who also fit with that description of the kinds of people who succeed here and who we want to surround ourselves with.
So do you have any tips you might want to share that you've learned in the hiring process of how you approach hiring to try to get the right fit with the culture you're trying to create and foster?
Well, as you might expect with someone who founded an analytics company, I actually do take a very data-driven approach to screening, at least on a final stage, people. I sat down with my leadership team about a year or so ago, and we actually talked and honed in on the 4 to 5 attributes that the people who have done really well here and who we can't hire enough of the same kind of person, frankly, what they all had in common in terms of their values and how they work. So we distilled that down to 5 things. I have a series of questions which help me back into the presence or absence of those things. And it's something that I do pretty systematically across the board, because we have definitely run into instances where somebody could be brilliant and a great fit for a particular role, but if they truly don't share the values of the team around them, it's going to cause friction, and not the good kind of creative friction, but the type where you can see that it's definitely a great person, but they're really on the wrong bus.
Yeah, no, that's actually, it's really great to hear that you're so analytical and thoughtful about the process, because a lot of leaders in early stage companies, as they're growing, are much more haphazard about it.
You just can't afford to be. You have to get clear about what you're looking for, because otherwise, I mean, we went from 10 people to north of 50 people. It felt like overnight. And when you meet that many people in rapid succession, there's a fatigue that sets in, and you find yourself going, gosh, he had a really great shirt on. Yeah, he'll be great. But you find that, I mean, that's obviously an exaggeration, but you find that you do remember some of those intangibles, and you haven't really screened people effectively if you don't truly understand what you're screening for. I think particularly in a startup, but I'm sure even as the company grows, it is hands down the most important thing to be meticulous about.
You're so right. And as I said, I think that most people, particularly in early stage companies, are not meticulous about it, and they pay dearly with the results.
Yeah, and it's, people often talk a lot about the financial cost, but it's also the time cost. It's the toll on the culture of having someone who isn't a fit. There's all sorts of badness that happens from being sloppy in that area.
Yeah. So let's I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about another factor that leaders have to deal with, which is a combination of emotions and tactics. And I'm wondering what you might be able to suggest as to how leaders can deal with emotional and tactical issues simultaneously when they come up.
So I think you're touching on something that is near and dear to what I think about, which is this concept of managing your state. It's at the risk of making it oversimplistic, exercise and diet, those are two critically important things, particularly if you're not sleeping as much as you perhaps might want to. I work out almost every day of my life. It is the best way I can think of to manage your emotions, to get any of the unwanted stuff that really shouldn't be a factor in decision making just out of your body. And if you think about it, when you're an entrepreneur, and this is true for when you're an employee too, you're sitting at your desk, you're bombarded from lots of different directions by potentially emotion-inducing statements or situations, and you have to be healthy, because if you're not, you're going to react in a way that you perhaps wouldn't have if you'd just gone for a really long run. So at the risk of sounding too simplistic there, you really do have to be very regimented about keeping that up. Because before you know it, you're like flipping out over something that wouldn't even upset you on a decent night's sleep. So that's the first part, is just, you know, taking care of all of that. But I think the second piece of it is just getting really clear about what you can achieve in a given week. So for me, I spend some time every Sunday afternoon thinking about the week ahead, looking at what I have lined up, and getting really clear on what are the two or three big ticket items that I want to see through by the end of this week. Because one of the biggest things that's going to hit you when you're growing a company is that you walk into the office and then everything you've planned for the day just changes. You've got people at your desk, you know, there's these things blowing up that you didn't even know were things, and you have to be very disciplined to stay on course and very clear about what success looks like for you. And that's a function of listening to the environment and reacting, but also staying on course and setting your own particular plan for the week.
Do you have any personal tips to offer that help you manage the important when what seems urgent to somebody else sort of creeps over your threshold?
It's about being clear for yourself. You can never necessarily look at someone and go, hey, that's really not important to me right now. You definitely have to give everyone the airtime and the opportunity to let you know about things which, at least within their purview, are incredibly important. And you listen and you weigh. So I think you do have to invest that time. It's your job. But for you, you always have to bring that back into this context of what are the really high ROI things that I need to be doing? Should this make my top three? Because mind you, you know, you'll go into a week sometimes, I'll have my two or three things that are top, and then something will happen that actually trumps them. But it's very rare. So I think it just comes back down to giving everyone the airtime, making sure you're making time for people, but also always weighing it in the context of what you actually really do need to be doing to move the needle. Because otherwise you can have an incredibly busy, incredibly quote unquote successful week in terms of clearing off small tasks, but you really didn't do a single thing that drives the value of the company or that brings the whole team in a direction that you need to be going.
You're so right. And Gary Keller in the book, The One Thing, tries to teach a framework that helps people to identify what are those top things in your life that you need to do every week, that if you do them, it's really going to drive success.
Yeah, it's an ongoing thing and you have to just keep practicing it.
Yes. Tanya, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how leaders can balance attributes that seem dichotomous, such as confidence and open-mindedness, or creativity and practicality, or determination and flexibility.
For me, it comes down to just being authentic. And I don't know if you consciously ever balance these things. If you are a creative person, you're just going to bring that into your leadership style. You're just going to value certain things. You can be confident, but also open. I don't think they necessarily cancel each other out. But I think for me, at least, it always just comes down to bringing you back to what's most important, which is, you know, continuing to execute on the core vision of your company, being open, being honest. And I think the rest comes down to style. You know, I happen to be a little more casual. It's just how I am. I'm from Australia. You know, there's a certain sensibility that I bring to the role, which might not work for someone else. So it's about going, who am I and how do I stay me, but also execute on all of these other things? I think you can fall into a trap of trying to behave like you believe the role requires, and that can cause a lot of problems, because when you're trying to be something that you're not, you are not comfortable and everyone around you can see that, and it's not fun, and these are all bad things.
Yeah, that makes sense. Tanya, do you think that challenges differ for women and men, particularly in your field in media and tech?
Well, speaking from my amazing experience of having done this as a man previously, I don't know. I get asked that a lot. I suspect that it's different for being a woman. I don't truly know how. I think perhaps the biggest difference is just, again, you know, there can be some baggage that comes with it where people sort of say, oh, well, you know, you've got to speak up more or you've got to do these other things. I just think it comes down to just be good at your job, have a clear vision for your company. Don't get hung up on any one of the myriad reasons why somebody might not like you or might not listen to you, which may or may not have anything to do with who you are or what gender you are or how old you are. I mean, that's another one, you know, being young, like, do you have to overcompensate for it? And I just think just get the job done and do it the best you can and be good. And I think the rest of it sort of falls into place.
Makes a lot of sense. Tanya, what have been some of your own personal ups and downs?
Gosh, where to begin? It happens daily, right? Where you balance priorities, work to manage your state, you have to constantly be backcasting where you want your company to be in a couple years and the kinds of key things that need to happen to get there. So I think that's sort of the roller coaster that you're on pretty much a daily basis, and things go your way and sometimes things don't go your way, and you have to just get really clear that you're still the same person, it's still the same company, and the highs are never as high and the lows are never as low. It's hard to try and be reasonable like that, and you know, you always do want to really ride those highs when they're there. But the flip side of that is it can be very easy to overemphasize the negative. And I always really have to check myself and think about it in perspective and make sure that you're not putting undue weight on things which maybe don't warrant that amount of worry.
Yeah, perspective is really important. That's actually it's a great comment. What questions do you wish you had answered when you hit a plateau?
The biggest question is, how have I gotten through something like this before? I think it's very easy to fall into the trap of believing that a given situation is unique and it's never happened to you before, and what do you do? And there's a certain paralysis that can sink in there. But what I like to do in those situations is think about, you know, when has something like this happened to me before, and what did I do and how did I get through it? And that's probably the most pragmatic thing you can do, because even if you can't find something that's identical, you can be like, oh, I remember this happened and I did this and this. And then you get that confidence to go, okay, well, I've done it once, I can do it again. You know, this is a temporary setback. It's not going to destroy me. It's just something which is happening right now, but that isn't going to be never ending.
Right. It also puts things in perspective. That's actually a great piece of advice. And what have been some of your biggest successes?
Probably the biggest overall was moving from Australia and moving across the world. It was, you know, Australia is a beautiful life. I'm born and raised in Sydney and it's very, very comfortable, but I definitely had that drive to experience what it was like elsewhere and also to kind of be in a market that was among the biggest in the world. But, you know, it's definitely very uncomfortable. You don't know anyone, you don't really have any particular inns within a new market. And when you're coming from a place like Sydney, which is a wonderful city, but very, very small, and you know everyone and you've gone to school with everyone, that can be a really big leap. So that's probably the biggest, you know, it sounds like, oh, well, you just bought a plane ticket, pat yourself on the back. But psychically, that was a very big milestone for me.
No, it's a huge shift. It's a different place, a different country, a different culture, not quite a different language, but
it's pretty close to a different language. You'd be surprised. And I still get tripped up on that. You'd be surprised how many times, even now, and I've been here almost 10 years, where you open your mouth, say something, and no one in the room has any idea what you're talking about.
Tanya, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you're working on now that's really exciting.
Sure. So the predictive analytics part of our practice is my biggest, newest shiny toy here, where, I mean, we're sitting on probably the world's largest repository of social performance data when it comes to how brands succeed or fail on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter. So we've got a huge practice around data which sheds light on what's happening. But now have really been running head on towards taking that data and using it to predict outcomes and to empower our customers to actually use what they've done and use what everyone else in the marketplace has done to make fundamentally better decisions. And it's sort of, it takes that concept of test and learn, and it sort of goes, well, you know what, the whole world's been testing for years. Now you're just going to learn based on it, and you're going to make better decisions that don't require the waste and don't require the amount of investment to see what's going to work, because that's already been done for you. And that's, you know, a huge untapped well of intelligence, and it's the thing that I'm focusing almost all my time on right now, that I'm really excited about being able to bring to market.
Is this the core of what you do at Shareably?
It absolutely is. It's probably the biggest driver for why I set out to build the company from the beginning, was because I just looked at social content and couldn't fathom why some pieces succeeded and others failed, and wanted to be able to unpack what made them unique and different and successful. And now, over the past couple of years, we've just amassed such a wealth of data and such a strong analytics practice that we can bring this towards executing on predictive analytics across social, where hopefully it not only takes social data to make social better, but it also takes the wealth of information that can be learned from social behaviors to really make business better. And that's kind of the big leap that we're seeing in the marketplace that I'm really spending most of my time thinking about and really sitting with brands and publishers and getting their thoughts on.
Look, understanding why something works or doesn't work is really fundamental.
It really is. And people just don't have enough time to have the guesswork. You know, they just need something that takes the guesswork out of it.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, it's very exciting, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about it as you continue to develop and grow your company.
Oh, you bet. It's pretty much all I talk about these days, so you may regret knocking on that door, David.
I don't think so. Sounds very exciting. Tanya, could you tell us a little bit about who has been influential to you as you have moved forward in your career?
There's definitely been a lot of books that I've read. I'm a big fan of biographies. Probably the biggest has been reading a lot of the stories and narrative on Richard Branson. Huge fan. I just love the unexpected approach to entrepreneurship and how he's really avoided getting pigeonholed in one type of business versus the other. And the theme that stitches things together are things that he thought were valuable or interesting. I really like that unconventional approach. It's unexpected, and you know, that's always, I'm always trying to, you know, I mean, you can learn so many things from somebody like Steve Jobs and who had that sort of clarity of vision and this kind of unrelenting view on what good looked like. And I think there's a lot of inspiration to be drawn from that. But I also really like to model myself on people who have synthesized many of the values that I really hold as high levels of things to aspire to for myself.
I have to tell you, a lot of my guests on Smashing the Plateau have talked about how unexpected opportunities have really helped propel their success.
Yeah, I think one of the, I mean, I, aren't all opportunities pretty much unexpected? I think part of it is, you know, I remember reading a wonderful thing, I forget who said it, was saying that, you know, you want to place yourself high enough so that opportunity can see you. And I think, you know, all of the work you do sort of lines you up to being ready when an opportunity falls into place. But you almost just have to do the work. And then when some great opportunity comes up, you seize on it. It's about, you know, getting ready and then being prepared to act once it really does come your way.
Well, you know, one of the things that we see in business is that I'm not sure whether to call it a friction or an imbalance or what it is between the necessity to plan and always be planning, like strategic planning, business planning, etc., and the necessity to be open to opportunity, because plan A is rarely the one that comes to fruition. It's like, when do you do need to plan and you need to move forward based on your plan, but then when do you pivot and accept an opportunity that shows up totally out of the blue?
I think the answer to both is yes.
Exactly. No, it is.
Here's my take on it. So your plans will almost never come to fruition, right? But you learn so much about what you value, what you believe, what you're working on, what you stand for in the process of planning, that the outcome of your initial plans almost don't matter, but the work that goes into thinking through the scenarios and thinking about how the world's going to evolve, it just means that you're ready. And then when the world begins worlding as it does, you react to that, and you've already got a methodology in your back pocket, and you've already got thinking points and all of these different layers, which if you just kind of showed up without any planning, you'd just be sort of doing that on the fly. But it's something that I've observed about myself as well, is that I can occasionally come off as, oh, well, you know, I'm being spontaneous, or I'm being very in the moment. But that's the result of really, really meticulous planning and work and thinking, so that when you go into a situation, you essentially throw it all away, but you've already done it so many times that that it can appear spontaneous, but really it isn't. And I think you need both. You know, you don't plan because you want to create a rigid structure and how everything's going to map out, because you're going to be sorely disappointed. But if you don't plan, you'll really have no chance at being able to succeed, you know, with anything that really comes your way.
It's so true. Tanya, I know that you work really hard. That's really clear from everything we've discussed. I wondered if you could tell me something about what you do for fun.
It's a dangerous question, right? How do you separate fun from work?
You don't have to separate them. So you can answer it however you like.
Yeah, you really don't. And I think if you have an expectation that, you know, you're going to work between these hours and then you're going to do stuff for fun, it sort of automatically suggests that what you're doing doesn't feed you and it isn't enjoyable. So I really, I struggle with that dichotomy. I'm really bad at being unhappy. I have to love what I do. It's sort of a precondition to getting started. But you know, you also do want to draw inspiration from lots of different things. I think the biggest thing I can say on this point is, when you find yourself getting stuck into a particular way of thinking, you do have to consciously do things that mix it up. And maybe you could call that fun, but it can be very simple things like go to an art gallery and see a new exhibition, or listen to a kind of music that inspires you, or just go for a walk or see something in a different neighborhood. Anything which can actually break your pattern or a groove of thinking that you have is incredibly helpful, because it is very easy to get stuck and to, you know, even when you're diversity seeking or variety seeking, it is still very easy to kind of get stuck in those grooves of your pattern, so to speak. So you do have to consciously shake that up in whatever way, you know, feeds you. For me, it's those things, but it could be anything.
Sounds good. Tanya, whom do you know personally who's doing really remarkable work?
The probably the thing which is inspiring me the most right now is a very dear friend of mine who is doing a lot of work on digital governance. And she thinks a lot about how to take this technology that we've been building on top of and use it to make government much more transparent, use it to create ways in countries outside of America that people can really feel like they're having their voice heard. And I think that democratization that came with digital didn't necessarily filter out everywhere. And I mean, she's doing a lot of that work in Australia where I'm from, but it's true everywhere where if people don't feel like what they believe is heard or is relevant, they become very disengaged with those systems. So I'm a huge fan of taking all of this good technology, and you know, we actually contribute data to her research too, because there's a lot that can be learned from it. But it kind of takes all of this wonderful sort of marketing information and flips it on its head and really helps empower people to make better decisions and craft societies that they believe in.
Sounds groundbreaking.
Very, very cool. Yeah, she just did her master's at Columbia and is now kicking off a huge thing in digital governance. Erica Willis.
Wow. Tanya, please tell listeners how they can learn more about you.
Oh, you bet. Anything to do with social information or any of the data is available on our website, shareably.com. And that links off to a blog that has lots of really great information about how the marketplace is growing and how different categories are evolving. So that's probably the best place. We're also on Facebook, on Twitter, same word, Shareably.
It sounds great. Tanya, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. It's been great chatting with you about leadership and entrepreneurship and business. My guest today has been Tanya Yuki, founder and CEO of Shareably. Thank you again, Tanya, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.